Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode to sit down with someone. It's always nice to go back and kind of remember the scenes that happened before and the scenes that I was part of when I was in a band and when I kind of was playing music all those many years ago. And there was bands I used to go and see and really was quite enamoured with and wondered kind of what happened with those bands, was the situation. So it's always nice to revisit the old scene that I remember and kind of see where those people are and what they're doing now. So it's nice to talk to an old friend, Alex, today on the show about kind of the band he was in, Obsolete. And then it's what he's been doing and what he's kind of up to and what his future plans are. Where this is probably going to be a two-parter, if I'm totally honest, where we kind of talk about the next project. We hinted at near the end of this show, but the next sort of project that he's involved with. But it was excellent because there was the names of bands I'd long since forgotten, unfortunately, and was reminded of. And that's one of the things that happens when a scene kind of happens that we know doesn't exist, where a scene kind of happens and starts to bloom, is that people look back and see some of the bands that maybe got a bit of a short shift of what should have happened and maybe should have been a bit a lot bigger than they were. We talked to Andy from Ogun on a previous episode where they've kind of come back and they're playing their sound better than they ever have. And we certainly talk about that. And we talk about the usual stuff that we go through, about how we got into metal and music and stuff. And it's just so nice to catch up with someone from the scene. And a lot of these bands you won't even know the names of. If you listen to this in other countries, you'll be like, who the fuck are these bands? And some of them haven't even got music out there. They never got to record. And this was the days before streaming, before all this type of thing happened. So it's really, really cool to give those bands a name check again and revisit some of those days when there was the scene kind of started to rise, maybe didn't get to where it needed to be. But these guys and these bands, walked till we could run. It was simple as that. And so it was really nice to sit down and have a conversation with my friend Alex Holborn. And I hope you enjoy it. I hope that these conversations I have with a lot of these people, this is the first time that they're on podcasts and have been approached and have never been on a podcast in any way, shape or form. And I always try and make it as an enjoyable as experience as possible, and give them a chance to feel comfortable talking about the music and that they love. If you are someone listening to the show and you're in a band and maybe you're thinking, I should really get into being on podcast and I should really try and plug my band and talk about my band on a podcast, the Spoken Metal Show's for you. The DMs are always open. Come and approach me and we'll have a conversation. We'll get you on the show. I'll promise it'll be a fun experience. Hopefully, you can swear and I don't edit any of this shit at all. It's presented exactly how it is. And you get a lot from it. So if you wonder, if you are out there thinking, I want to go on a podcast, I want to talk about these things that I'm really into, then feel free to get in touch with me. A lot of people already have, and a lot of people have sent some really fucking really nice messages. It's not always easy to kind of produce content. It's not always easy to as many shows as I can. And everybody has those moments where you don't feel as though it's making any difference, and you don't feel as though what you're doing is of importance. But it's nice every so often when you get messages from strangers, people that I've never met, that are telling me I'm doing some good work here, and that's I thank you. I really do. I thank you for that. It really means a great deal. It gets me through those lulls, and I know they're only transitory before I move on to feeling good. But even when you're feeling good and when you're happy and when things are going well, you should always be mindful that they're probably going to go shit again for a little bit as well. And that's the way of life, isn't it? There's good and bad and everything. It's just your outlook. And so I really, really thank that messaged me, and I've had voice messages as well, which is a very cool thing to get off people, which is super sweet and super nice to get, because it's real. It's a real person saying really nice things. So that's very cool. Keep them coming. If you are in a band and you want to get presented in some way on the show, we'll sit down. We did Tailgun the last episode, which is hugely well received, and we sat down and we talked and we prompted their album. We can do track by track. We can just talk and rap about the scene, whatever you want to do. Get in touch and we'll make it happen. But for now, please enjoy my conversation with Alex Holborn. Nice to have Alex on the show. Sir, welcome, and thanks for coming on, more importantly.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome to the show. How are you doing? All right, sir?
Thanks very much. Great pleasure to be here. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Yeah, we're doing all right. We had a little bit of a conversation before we got on, ladies and gentlemen, because there's so much to go through, mate. And we're definitely gonna have to do another one. There's gonna be probably a few of these.
Hope so.
You know, I think the thing we were like, how do we do this? Because there's so much to talk about. But
yeah,
I think, you know, you've been in and involved in the scene for a long time. So there's loads of stuff that I want to ask and loads of like points of views I want to get from yourself. But
I
always tend to start these things with where you first get into music, maybe not even metal, but music itself. And so where's that start for you, Al?
Well, I mean, going way back, I always loved music, even when I was a little kid. You know what I mean? I was always sort of asking my mom when the radio was on, what is this? And, you know, when I sort of got into my teen years, that's when I started playing guitar. And obviously that really sort of takes your interest in music to the next level, because you start becoming a part of it in a small way. And when I first started playing, honestly, I was into a lot of I think a lot of metalheads do this, but not that many would admit it. I was into a lot of pop punk, you know, I was into Blink-182, Green Day, that kind of thing when I started playing. And then eventually I sort of discovered Metallica, Pantera, Slayer, all that stuff. And that's when I sort of really got into it. But yeah, I mean, I've always had just a great love for music. And obviously as I sort of got into my teen years, that sort of manifested into, you know, getting involved with the local scene.
Yeah.
Which I think we're of sort of a similar age. So we were probably around the metal scene in Liverpool roughly the same time, right?
Yeah. About that, I think we were kind of certainly, you know, when I was in a band, almost certainly you were playing as well. Like, and that's that's why it's been, ladies and gentlemen, we've been back and forth and to get Alex on the show, because it's very sort of specific time period that we were talking about. But there's so much. I mean, when you first started,
really, isn't it? Yeah,
it's massive. It's like when you first started, was it really close to listening to music and then starting to play, or was it a couple of years before, or it was like almost at the same time?
No, like I said, I mean, music was always something that I loved, but I would say the time between me discovering, you know, so-called proper music, as in, you know, not just what was on the top 40 that week, you know, it's just, guitar-based music, basically, you know.
It's like you listen to the radio is kind of like your first couple of days at school with music, isn't it? You find out, you listen to all kinds of stuff. There's lots of stuff going on there. Different genres, and you're okay. Ah, I quite like that genre. I'm going to move towards that, isn't it? And then you kind of go, okay,
if I had to put it down to one moment, where it really became clear that I was going to go down sort of a metal kind of path, it was, I remember watching Top of the Pops one weekend, and obviously it's your usual stuff on there. And then Iron Maiden appeared out of nowhere playing The Wicker Man. Brave New World. So that was, I guess that was 99, 2000, something like that.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what the fuck is this? Do you know what I mean? Just like absolutely blown away. Pyrotechnics on stage and everything, like Bruce Dickinson just bounding about. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. Let me look into this a bit more.
And, I love it when that happens in sort of like society, when there's like the norm and every so often metal just gets in on the back door every now and again.
That's it, yeah.
You know, it's nice. I was watching an old Top of the Pops from a long time ago. Every so often, the fun to watch, just to kind of get a bead on what was happening in the 70s and the 80s. And there was one episode where Judas Priest were on playing United.
Wow.
And I don't expect a lot of people to know these songs. It's quite a deep cut for it, even though it was in the charts.
Yeah.
And it's like a football anthem.
Yeah.
It's like Rob Halford. And these people in the audience have no fucking idea what to do with it, because it's Rob Halford. They're all leathered up. And they're singing a song that's like a football anthem, and made the crowd, you know, they don't know how to sway or how to dance or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. Just
bewildered.
Those moments, like you say, when you see that, you go, oh, that's, I like that direction.
But I think those moments are really important. Like, I mean, recent years, you know, you've had the Metallica thing with Stranger Things and all that. And, you know, a few metalheads might get a bit sort of elitist about it, but it's like, as far as I'm concerned, that's going to open a door to, you know, millions of young people getting into metal, and some of them are going to start bands, and some of them are going to be great. Do you know what I mean? So
You're saying a mouthful there, Alex, because you're 100% right, is that when we all talk about where the next generation of like headliners are coming from for like Bloodstock or Download or whatever, that's actually where they're coming from. Those kids who are going, I saw that song on Stranger Things, let's deep dive and let's get into metal. Then I'll form my band, then I'll play, then I'll da-da-da-da-da. And that's before long, you know, 10 years down the line, they're the bands that are headlining or coming up on the bills, isn't it? That's exactly how it happens.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, like you say, to think to be elitist about that is fucking math. It's madness, then, isn't it, when you think about it?
It's like, what, did you never start listening to, you know, Enter Sandman, and did you just go straight to, you know, Mortician or whatever, did you? You know, it's like you didn't go straight to whatever cult metal band you're into now. You went through the usual channels that everyone else did. So, you know.
Yeah. No one ever, the first piece of music they hear is the first band they're into, and it's the best example of that. You go through many, many different iterations. So when you're sort of listening to music, you decide, why then the guitar then? Why that is an instrument? You know, and not the drums or vocals, or why the guitar then? Why was that the first choice?
Do you know what it was? It was, I never fancied myself as a musician. Like I saw people doing it and I thought,
yeah,
I'm never going to be able to do that. That's just magic as far as I'm concerned. But I went round to my friend Matthew here, who I'd known from primary school, who was like a really gifted musician. Still is. He's like, you know, graduated from Birmingham Conservatoire and all that with honors. He's a sickeningly good musician and just like a really all round good guy. But we sort of moved back to Heighton as a teenager around that time when I was like 13, 14. And coincidentally, he was a couple of doors down. And we sort of go into his back room, you know, chatting awkwardly like teenagers do. And I look on his wall and it's like an Ibanez RG on there.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Look at that. That's amazing. And he starts playing it. And he was, you know, he's just going, just play this, but. And he just sort of gave me like an impromptu guitar lesson. You know, he told me the usual sort of, you know, Smoke on the Water, Hash Pipe by Weezer, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Just like simple riffs. And I just got an absolute bug for it, really. And I was just like, I need to get a guitar as soon as possible.
Like, it is seen like when you, I remember seeing my first guitar, which was a Les Paul copy in Hammersound, for anybody in the area will know that place. And there is that, like, I mean, it goes and it becomes something else. But at first, it's a magical thing, isn't it, when you see a guitar? I don't understand how that exists, how that makes it. I understand now the properties of pole pieces and magnetism and our amplification. I understand that now. But at the time, like, I 100%, when you say it's like magic, it seemed like, what, this makes a distorted sound. But I was blown away. I mean, I remember spending, like, hours palm muting.
I think the second sort of session we had, he's like, I said, how do you make it sound heavier? And he said, oh, well, one of the things you can do is palm mute. And I was like, what's that? And he goes, chuck, 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 chuck. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
it was like a race, wasn't it? To get anything to sound heavy, you were like, okay, what do I do to make it? Okay, well, a palm mute. Okay, so it's all the low strings. I understand.
One drop D.
I did everything to make it sound like the records that I was listening to. So when you're playing, who are you listening to from a guitar point of view then?
In the very early days, it was, like I say, it wasn't really metal. It was sort of I was listening to a lot of Green Day and stuff like that, and a lot of punk. Yeah. And I was playing along to that initially, which was handy because, like, if you're a beginner guitarist, like, pop punk is a really good sort of genre to play because it's all just sort of power chords. But what it really did for me is it developed my right hand skills.
Yeah.
So it made me good at, you know, strumming and having control over my right hand and palm muting and all the rest of it. So that when I started getting into, you know, Metallica, Slayer, whatever, that stuff was still a bit out of my reach in terms of my left hand skill, but I felt like my right hand could keep up with it. Yeah. And so I mean, when I really started getting into guitar, it was Metallica for the most part. Honestly, it was James Hetfield is still, you know, as a rhythm guitarist, still just like a god to me. Like, it's just unbelievable, even still at 60, whatever he is now. It was Hetfield, it was Dimebag. I didn't try to sound like Dimebag because I he's just complete. He's a complete unique guitarist. You know, he was one of a kind. But it was mostly that kind of stuff that I was listening to, and then a bit later I started to, you know, get a bit more advanced with the rhythm playing, maybe some like Arch Enemy stuff like that, Timmy Borgia. You know, that was just. Yeah. Trying to kind of push myself.
It's interesting you talk about, like, you know, punk being the access points because it's power chords. Yeah. And it's, you know, and one of the things that, you know, I think probably doesn't get the service it deserves is that, yes, punk is simplistic from a technical chordal based point of view and scalar based things. It's simplified. But in terms of performance, there's still, you know, you have to have really good rhythm chops. You do.
Absolutely,
you know, you have to have like you say, a highly developed right hand and coordination. You can't get away with that. Like, you know, you take something like the Ramones, you know, the classic punk band. Yeah. Try playing along to those records. You know, how fucking easy it is, you know?
Yeah, that's what I used to do. I used to play along to It's Alive, the live album by the Ramones, I still love that. It's got so much energy on it. But it's like, yes, the left hand stuff is really easy. But you know, if you, especially if you're a beginning guitarist, that, you know, it's really challenging to play that stuff like up to speed and all that. So I think obviously metal is a step up in terms of musicianship. But I think that starting on the punk stuff really sort of gave me the platform I needed to move up to that. Eventually, like, develop around that. I don't just consider myself a metal player, but that's sort of my, you know, go-to, obviously.
Yeah.
But I was just playing along to, and I would say this to anyone who's just picking up guitar for the first time now, whether you're, you know, 15 or a bit older, it's like, just play along to as much different stuff as you can. Like, whatever you're listening to, play along to as much stuff as you can, and eventually your brain will start to recognize the patterns and the, you know, the motifs that are going on in these different styles of music, and then before you know it, you'll be able to create the music that you want to create without thinking about it, really. So
one of the biggest pieces of advice I do give to young musicians is to just keep playing, keep on playing, because you will weed out naturally the things you like and don't like over time. You're like, I like the sound of that, so I'll lean into that, and I like the sound of it. And ultimately what should happen is you should be a sum total of all your influences, that it ultimately ends up like this. We get Dimebag because of, you know, Ace Frehley, and then you know, and people like that you can hear in him. And even with someone like even like Eddie, you still can hear bits of Jim Page in Eddie.
Oh,
and
they've
just kind of allowed it. The thing that I suppose that's leveled a lot out is that if you learn now, it's like, it's easier to learn. There's way more material out there, YouTube, and it's a lot of time. Certainly I was learning from guitar magazines, like imported from the States.
Yeah.
But now that sometimes gets leveled as the problem is that because it's so accessible and because there's so much information out there that you end up sounding like everybody else. You know what I mean? It's difficult to be original. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know what
you think.
I mean, that's kind of the way everything is with the internet now, with how accessible everything is. It's like stuff sort of loses its value. You know, it was like, I remember, I mean, I sound like an old man now, but, you know, digging out like, you know, finding a decent tab on, you know, whatever the website was at the time, back in the early 2000s, it was like gold dust, you know, finding one that was actually accurate. But now it's like, you've got Musician, you've got all these amazing resources. And I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think it's just different. And I think, like you say, there is no substitute, no matter what your sort of learning approach is, there's no substitute for just putting the hours in and just, like, if you have the passion for it, you'll just be driven to play guitar, especially around that age where you've got nothing else on. You know, you'll be driven to play guitar all the time, and you will get better. You know,
there was always someone for me. There was about two or three people that I could name now that were insanely good players. That you would see them on the scene, or you would go around to the house, and they would have, like, you know, mastered something really interesting or whatever it may be. Yeah. All we're seeing now with the birth of the internet and how that's influenced is that circle's just got bigger. That person now is someone in Japan, or, you know, amazing French guitar player or whatever. It's just in a different country, you know?
And that's who you're comparing yourself to,
yeah,
which is maybe not the healthiest way to go about it.
Because, yeah, well, I mean, comparison is the thief of joy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
There's always going to be someone better than you. But what you should do instead is, if you do see someone like amazing who's like 15 or 10 or whatever the fuck, who's fucking absolutely wailing, instead of going, oh shit, I'm bad because I'm not as good as them, you should go, wow, they're fucking amazing. I'm going to go away and try and be as amazing. I'm going to try and work on my own shit.
It doesn't take away, like, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so, someone else being further along than you doesn't take away from your sort of your journey. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's, I think healthy competition among your peers is really important as well. Cause like you say, around that time in the scene, like our guitarist, Woody, Adam Woodward, he was a bit of a prodigy. And Andy Barker, who, you know, loads of people know from Scare Tactics, was Hollow Point back then. He was like the, you know, the best guy on the scene. And Woody would constantly be trying to like step his game up and learn new stuff just so that next time we could compete. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It should be like friendly in that way. It should be like you go to see someone and go, fucking hell, they're amazing. Go away, try harder, come up with better songs, and then go, okay, let's fucking listen to this then. And that helps kind of perpetuate a scene, and it helps kind of build the quality level of a scene up as we'll get into that later, because I know we've got some thoughts on the scene as it was and as it is now. So when does it go from playing on your own to being with musicians? When's that happen?
Well, it started in school, really. I went to Blue Coat School around here, which I absolutely hated. But one of the good things about it was that they had a music room, which had a full back line in it. I still remember it. Like, I had a Vox amp, Yamaha Pacifica, Sama drum kit, and what's the bass on? It doesn't matter. But anyway, it had a full lineup, instruments and amps, which was like, you know, if you're a sort of fledgling musician, that's absolute gold dust, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we were me and Joel, who I ended up being an obsolete with, we would go up there. We were both sort of learning at the same time. I maybe started a few months before him, but you know, we were a couple of sort of fledgling metal heads who were just learning guitar. And we used to go up there every break time, every lunchtime, and after school for like 2 hours, because that was just how much we loved it. Do you know what I mean? And there was a small group of us around there who, you know, just a few lads a couple of years above, a few lads like year below us, and younger than that, like the institution. They went to our school as well, so they were sort of around a bit. And it was like, it was really exciting to sort of, it was like a daily thing. Like, we'd get tabs off the internet in IT, and then we'd learn them, and then we'd go and play them together in this little tiny music room, which, like, that became the first time that I actually played with other musicians, which obviously sort of takes you to that next level, you know? And that's where the band, that's where Obsolete came from, really, when we were 15 years old.
I love that magical thing of you all going away to your various bedrooms and houses, you know, woodshedding something and coming up with maybe a riff here or a thing here, and then coming back and wanting to experiment and try them out again. That's a wonderful, magical, creative environment, that, isn't it?
It was.
That's the absolute antithesis of being in a band, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the full credit to the music teacher at the time, Mr. Cook, because he initially, when we went up there, he'd be like, oh, fuck off, get out. You know, he'd shoo us out and away from the £1,000 worth of equipment or whatever. And but after a while, I guess he just thought to himself, well, you know, it's good that they're showing an interest in music. Yeah. So he would, you know, accidentally, quote unquote, leave the room unlocked all the time. And we'd just go in there all the time and practice. And honestly, like, if he hadn't have done that, you know, this band, the band we were in, would never have come to be, because that's how we started. Me and Joel, Woody was sort of light years ahead of us at the time, because he'd been playing for a couple of years sort of on the quiet, hadn't really told anyone about it, but I'd been having lessons and stuff, so he was just like unbelievably good for his age. And so I sort of made way for him, and then I discovered I could do metal vocals a bit, so I was like, oh, that's good, so I can just move to vocals. And then we got
Danny. So discovering metal vocals. That's fucking are you in the room, they're going, okay, we'll have a go with doing Sandman or something.
Yeah.
And you start singing, or what happens?
It was when we were playing, you know, all that stuff in the music room, and then we finally got together in Crash. So the first few like proper practices, and we didn't know what we were doing, you know. But luckily we had Joel's older brother, who's much older, he's like late 20s or something, Tony, who's in like Ethereal and stuff, good drummer. He came in and did the sessions with us, and we'd written this song, or they'd like written a song with sort of, they'd gone off together to write it, and we couldn't think of like what we were going to do lyrically, how we were going to approach it, whatever. I had no idea. And I'd been listening to quite a bit of I guess you call it punk or crossover hardcore kind of stuff, like Agnostic Front and stuff like that, Lars Fredriksson and the Bastards, like that kind of thing. I was still into a bit of that, and I just started screaming one of his songs over it because it had like a similar lyric to it, and yeah. I sort of surprised myself as I was like, whoa, where did that come from? It's like, okay, we're somewhere new now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that became very clear. It's like, okay, I'm a vocalist now. I'm not a guitarist in this band.
Wow.
But yeah, but I carried on playing guitar. And I mean,
yeah,
I wrote most of the first EPs, about half of it. I wrote about half the riffs on that. From that practice, it was clear though.
I think that's probably how a lot of various sort of metal singing probably happened, you know? Oh, yeah. Like, where there's a group of guys and they're like, okay. I mean, Pig Squeals and guttural stuff, all that probably was born from, I can't sing like what it's meant to sound like, like a pop song would sound. I can't do that. So I'm going to do this. This is what I've got.
Yeah.
And then it becomes these, now we can break it down, the death metal, and we can break this all down, these forms of singing. But I imagine when the first time, like, you know, someone like Chris Barnes and stuff starts going, and he probably didn't, it must have been like falling down a set of stairs and landing on your feet.
No, absolutely. You know, that's exactly what it was like for me as well, because I was like, I had no idea. I'd never tried to do that.
Yeah.
And it's just, I was taking the piss, really. Do you know what I mean?
And then I was the first thing you do is you try and make light of it, don't you? Until you start going, okay, well, this is actually how it is meant to sound. Now I've got to actually dial it in and be able to do it over and over again. But at the first time, it's almost comical. It's almost comical.
It definitely was, And it's just, and you kind of take yourself aback with it. And then, you know, it just goes on from there. It was like a couple of years ago, I made a black metal song on my iPad for kind of for fun, like just to see if I could do it. I was just taking a piss a little bit, and I just thought, no, I actually really enjoyed that. Let me see if I can do it. And then before you know it, I end up doing like, you know, an EP, and here we are a couple of years later. I'm doing another one with Matty, which we can talk about later. But what anything that you start doing as a piss take, there's a good chance that you'll end up doing it for real. So you know,
Yeah, because do you know why I think it is? If I could level why I think that might be, is because it doesn't take itself seriously. Therefore, it's not open to the same rules as something that does. So if you go, this is my very, very serious thing that I'm doing, very, very serious, then all rules come into play. Well, it can't be this and it must follow this. I'm sure that when Patton started doing Mr. Bungle, that was based purely from, I want to do this because it sounds fucking ridiculous, and I'll do these things, and it makes me smile. I don't give a fuck about the constraints that like something like the Faith No More might have. I'll do Mr. Bungle, and this is, and that's where I tip my hat to, because that's probably where some of the coolest stuff comes from.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's always been a piss taker pattern, but he's also, you know, an insanely respectable musician and vocalist. He's incredible, you know, and his back catalog is you know. You can put it up there with anyone's really. And it's I think music kind of comes from that same place, like not just in metal or whatever, but most music comes from that place of like playfulness, you know?
Yeah.
So it's that part of the, I forget if it's left side or right side brain, but you know, it's that part of the brain, whatever that is, that just wants to just have fun and express itself.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of use the other sort of more analytical problem solving side of your brain to finesse that into, you know, the final
It's a weird. It's interesting you say that because it's that weird thing metal has, right? Where the music that's put forward is incredibly brutal and sometimes very stark and disturbing and serious. Probably though, by the musicians that take themselves the least seriously, if you know what I mean. And radio, like we talk about Dime McDowell, you know, plays some of the most crushing riffs of all time. Guy's an absolute bantam master. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely,
constantly taking the pit. And it's that weird and wonderful dichotomy of metal, you know, isn't
it? Like I'm reminded of Strapping Young Lad as well. Yeah. I mean, they were always like one of the goofiest bands around, but also one of the heaviest and just.
Yeah.
Most visceral bands you'd ever see.
Yeah, the two kind of belie each other, don't they? It's kind of, it always makes it even heavier because it's, you know, it's like Lawnmower Death. I remember seeing Lawnmower Death a long time ago and they were as equal parts funny as equal parts insanely heavy.
Yeah.
And
it
was like, I love that, like that dichotomy. It's like it's a musical equivalent of the American Werewolf in London. You know, it's like, it's the two things inhibiting the same, same space.
You do find that, you know, you go to like a metal show and they'll be full of the nicest people you can possibly meet, but they'll have t-shirts full of, you know, gore and horrible slogans and all stuff like that. And it's like, I'd love seeing people who aren't used to the scene sort of try to get their heads around that. Do you know what I mean?
It can be quite jarring.
Like someone wearing a Cannibal Corpse shirt and it's like, you know, the most approachable, nice guy that you've ever met.
I proposed it before that I think I know that why that may be the case is that, if you're a death metal vocalist, you have to leave it all on the stage. You know, does that look, it's that intense? It's like going to the gym. Once you've worked out, you're spent. You're not going to be fighting anybody or arguing with anybody because you released all this energy. It's the same with a metal guitarist or a metal vocalist. Yeah. There's that much of a release. You can't carry anything with you after.
Absolutely, it's catharsis. That's what it is. That's what I've always loved about metal is it makes you feel like that. Whether you're just, I mean, it's the same when you're listening to it. If I'm sort of pissed off or stressed or whatever, and I listen to, you know, a great metal album that I love, it's like I don't feel that same way afterwards. I feel better. You know, I feel vindicated. I feel like it's been a cathartic experience, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, just forgetting to breathe.
Alex, it's because you're talking about something that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. It's like when you know, like the misinterpretation is that metal, and especially metal, like sort of the heavier end of it, the more extreme end of it, is in some way kind of like damaging to you. And it's reverse. It can be incredibly free. And it's like, I feel fucking better after that, or I feel empowered, you know, like, or it's like you say, vindicated. There's an incredible catharsis to it. Yeah, incredible. So
someone else feels angry, I feel angry as well, and we connect with that. Do you know what I mean? And we sort of heal from it.
Yeah.
Together,
yeah.
You want to get a bit hit.
So when does it go then? So you're playing together in a room. When do you take those tentative steps out to go into playing live then?
Well, the first place we started playing live was, and I want to give a big shout out to Phil Hayes at this point, was the Flying Picket in Liverpool on Hardman Street. Excuse me. They had a dry bar gig. I think it was every Tuesday, which I used to go to like religiously. And it was basically for bands like us who were just starting out to play their first gig. And it was full of people our age, you know, people sort of 14 to 16, a bit older, a bit younger. And it was just, it was an amazing thing to be part of. Like even as just a punter, it was a great thing to be part of. You know, it was like a free gig or it's a pound or something to get in.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, I mean, going when you're 14, you know, you want to go to a gig like all the time, but you never got any money, but you didn't need money to go. You just need to get your parents to drop you off and you could do this. And it's, so used to be a lot of like, it was like punk bands like Surge were playing there. And I remember seeing Ogun a lot of times there. And I was already a fan of them. And then met Andy, became a friend of his. And sort of, I was like, oh, I've got this band together. You know, how do we go about sort of getting on the bill and all that? And before you know it, we're playing our first gig, May 2013. I think we'd been together a couple of months, something like that. I think we played like mostly covers, but a couple of originals in there as well. And I mean, you're playing to the Flying Pit. I guess it was about a 200 capacity, something like that. But it was full every time.
Yeah.
It was like, and it was, an amazing start for, you know, kids who didn't have any gear. Sometimes they didn't have a guitar.
Yeah.
But they had a full lineup there.
Yeah.
You know, a proper PA system and everything that you could play these quite chaotic.
It was, yeah, gigs, I remember being incredibly free in such as you can make your own flyers and shit. And,
oh, yeah.
And it was just this one. The thing that I remember fondly about it was that it was a lot of people's first kind of inference into the scene. So they've been playing in their bedroom or, like yourselves, playing in a room as a band. And they were going to this place because they knew, they'd heard that this is where you could make a noise.
Yeah.
And then they were going there meeting these other people and having their minds blown. It's like, oh, there's more people like me.
Absolutely.
And we can work together to put a show on and a bill on. And there's a thing that can happen. It became this wonderful space. I mean, shout out to Phil, the picket. It was a wonderful venue. Wonderful
it was amazing.
Venue in that respect.
I mean, I met so many people who I'm still friends with now. I met there. Yeah. And honestly, like half of the musicians I know, probably more than half, been from Liverpool. That's where they started. And there was nowhere else that you could play, you know. But what I mean, once we'd done a few gigs there, I mean, we were still only babies, you know what I mean? We were still like 15, 16. So it was like we were limited in where we could play, but we figured out that Hannah's Bar down the road, who had a room upstairs, didn't ask too many questions. as long as he got paid, they were like, okay, let's just assume that you're all 18.
It was a really, I liked Hannah's Bar because it was like a, it was pretty square room, and you weren't on a raised stage. It was flat, and I just remember it being like really good. God Christ, I saw so many bands there. Like,
you used to have Whiplash on there, didn't you?
Yeah, Whiplash. Yeah. And Sal used to do
there
that
a few times. Yeah,
yeah, and it became this like sort of that whole run up the road, at, like the Picket, and then Hannah's Bar, and then as you kind of went down to the other venues, and then I suppose. The Pilgrim and stuff used to do stuff upstairs as well. It became like a real scene. You could feel it brewing. Like, yeah, that's
sure, yeah.
To love Hannah's Bar. Like, yeah.
I mean, most of the musicians, like I say, weren't old enough to be in there, but it was in a time where, there'd be a blind eye turned to it. You know? So for the first couple of years, we were just sort of winging it. We were hoping that we weren't going to get kicked out, and thankfully we never did. But so it was... Excuse me. It was the Picket, Hannah's Bar, Heebie-Jeebies a couple of times. It was bands like Ogun were, they sort of became like big brothers to us, really. Like they were a year or two older than us, and they'd, you know, been on the scene longer. So we sort of got along really well with them, and we always liked it when we played with them. And Hollow Point were around at that time as well. Obviously, Scare Tactics still going to this day. We played those venues quite a lot, and then towards the end of that year, I said 2003, recorded the first EP that we did. So I think that was 5 tracks, and it was a good effort. Like, it was quite impressive for our age, I think, but there was still a sort of like an amateurishness about it, you know. And it took us another year or two of playing more gigs and, you know, getting more experience to kind of shake that off. And that's what I would say. Another thing I would say to young musicians is just play as much as you can. Don't be selective about it. You know, we unfortunately sort of got like that towards the end. We were like, oh, we've been offered a gig. And like one of us would say, oh, who's playing? Who's playing? You know, and then it's like, no, I don't want to play that. It's like, you don't want to do that. Just
be
as open as you can.
This now, because, I mean, Christ, there's an enormous amount to unpack there. But, you know, the timing when you were playing was a time, ladies and gentlemen, when there wasn't the structure and the ecosystem that there maybe is now.
Yeah.
So, like, you would literally just turn up sometimes. You know, there was this is what's going on. You couldn't organize it on the internet, so to speak. That really wasn't there. You just used to meet up at places and off you would go. And if the bills were worked out kind of right there and then and stuff like that. Yeah. It was all very ad hoc and it was all still growing. Now it's very much a complete thing. And I think because now there's a lot more structure to it, people are, like you say, coming up with rules. Like we talked about, it's like, you know, the rule of don't play too often in your hometown. And,
yeah, yeah.
And all these kind of rules. And I get why that goes on. But I also think that every gig can be important and every gig can be useful as long as it's approached that way. You know, if you like, you say, you start going, well, I don't like who's on the bill, you may be missing the fucking point.
No, absolutely. And I won't call him out, but it was one particular member of our band who most often did that. And it used to do my head. And every time I was like, why are we being selective? Like, we're not. It wasn't
what
like.
What was the thought process then about?
I guess he thought that it was like, if the lineup's sort of like not metal enough, do you know what I mean? And I think that maybe came up from the Dry Bar days, to be honest, when like a lot of time we'd end up being on with like local rappers and stuff like that, and it was a bit sort of jarring. So I get that, but it's like, you know, come on. We can go on with a rock band. It's not a big deal. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's one of the ways you improve as a band, ladies and gentlemen, is you go to the situations that are not already won. So if you're in a metal band and you get put on with four other metal bands, chances are people watch it from wherever the fuck happens. Okay, it's another metal band to watch it. It's almost an easy win. Yeah. It's almost an easy win. If you go on with, say, three hardcore bands and you're the only metal band on, you're going to have to work a little bit to get that crowd moving. That working a little bit is you learning to be... Like, I'll give you an example. Yeah. So, you know, someone like the Foo Fighters recently played Glastonbury. Now, they're not a metal band per se. They're more of a rock band, obviously. But they're still playing to a crowd that didn't really... You know, I'm sure that they loved them, but there's probably elements of that crowd that didn't give a fuck about them. They were like, yeah, it's the Foo Fighters, but I'm here for the dance acts. I don't care. So if you want to win some people over, as I'm sure they did, you've got the people who love you. They're always going to turn up for you. But you're going to have to work hard to do that. Yeah. And I've often found, especially in Europe when I've been touring, is that if there's a one metal band on that bill, they're knocking their pan out to win you over.
Oh, yeah.
Because they know they don't belong there. And it's almost like if you can do that, then you can win when it comes to the point where you're touring with a much larger band, where even if you are a metal band, they still don't give a fuck because they want to see that band that's headlining. Now you're used to that, and you're used to that mentality of the crowd going, right, well, you're going to have to be fucking good here, boys, otherwise I don't want to know. So you learn to fucking get really deep calluses and really tough calluses to deal with that, that almost kind of, you know, indifference that you can find. Did you find that then?
I did, yeah, and I always sort of saw it as a challenge, like you say. You know, if you're on a bill where the crowd isn't a metal crowd, you know, we played a few gigs like that. Like we played, I remember we played a Tsunami Benefit once, you know, for that Tsunami end of 2004. That was we were the only metal band. We were the only band that was remotely heavy on the bill, and there was a lot of people there, but it was not our crowd. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and we knew that going on, but we're like, let's just make the most of it. Let's see if we can win some people over. And it was, I think it was one of the best gigs we did, to be honest, even though it was still early on. The material wasn't that great yet. Like, it was one of the best performances we gave because we just thought, right, fuck it, let's take this on. Do you know what I mean?
I suppose, like, the way to approach it, certainly for the younger musicians out there playing now, is if you're faced with these challenges from a live perspective, let's say there's only five people watching you. That's a challenge then now. That's not a negative. That's now a challenge.
That's five potential fans. That's what that is.
Exactly, yeah. That's five potential people that you've got to fucking knock out the park and really impress, because they may go tell another five people and then you're at 10. And that's how you build it up. You know, if you're only going to try your best when there's a fucking big crowd that's into you, ladies and gentlemen, you are never going to get very big. You're never going to get to a live act, most certainly. You're going to have to get used to playing against with bands that you don't necessarily work well with, to crowds that are indifferent, to learn to play your own stuff and play it to the best of your ability. Yeah, it's interesting that, like, the times at sort of Hannah's Bar and Dry Bar and Heaven and Hell and these places.
Heaven and Hell,
the bands were just... There was a wonderful camaraderie between the bands, wasn't it? And it was absolutely quite a dichotomy of styles.
You know? Oh, yeah. And I mean, we get put on with, say, like Ogun, Zaprowski Connection, Hollow Point, Neva, and they're all completely different styles, really.
Yeah.
But we very much saw ourselves as like a community, because we were, you know, it was, excuse me, it was a very tight-knit community at that time. But that was good in a lot of ways. You know, we sort of had each other's backs, and we got very close and collaborated a lot and that kind of thing. So that was the great thing about the scene back then. It wasn't that big, but there was a real sort of, like you say, camaraderie about it, which I think is, it's harder to get that now. I think I'm not saying that the metal scene now isn't good. It is, but it's I don't know.
It's a different beast than it was.
It's then. Completely different. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, back then, because there was little to no internet, there was some, there was elements of it.
MySpace, that's about it.
Yeah, there was, like I say, there wasn't that ecosystem of kind of what it is now. And I think it was just, for me, it was one of those, it was a first wave of metal in Liverpool again after quite some time. And it was the start of that. And it kind of went and run its course and it went round again. And now I think we're maybe at the next two or three waves. Where we are now is the next sort of couple of waves of that.
Yeah.
Where you've got bands like Ogun coming back and playing shows and things
that's
like that.
That's great to see, by the way.
Yeah, it's amazing. And amazing to see them not miss a beat. Like, Andy's a fucking great player. You know, he's been on the show, you know, and to not miss a beat and to be go straight back onto it, you know, and realise that, you know, the metal is timeless in that respect, you know, that they can still be, that's heavy then, is still heavy now, you know.
I think they sound better now, to be honest. Like,
I 100% agree. Yeah. Well, they've got Neil Mellor, they've got the fucking... The Scouse Steve Vai, they've got.
Yeah. Danny's a great drummer as well. Danny's really good.
But did you see, do you see like sort of similar elements in the scene now when you go to shows and stuff? Do you see similar elements or is it?
One of the things that I think is never going to go away, and it sounds cheesy and all that, but it's true, is there's just that burning passion that the metal community has for this music just never goes away. So whatever the times are like, whatever we're dealing with, whatever, like you say, the ecosystem is, I think there will always be a scene that has the potential to be thriving. Do you know what I mean? I think it really, that's why I want to give you props for doing something like this show.
Awesome.
I think that's when, like, that's how scenes sort of survive and thrive, is by people putting a lot of effort in, like, you know, up front kind of thing. Without knowing where it's going, without knowing if it's going to be viable or not, and just taking a risk and just going out there and just, you know, starting a successful podcast or starting, you know, doing nights and putting gigs on and all that kind of thing. Just whatever way, starting a magazine, whatever way you can contribute to the scene is great and is a positive. And I think that there's still loads of people doing that, and people, you know, much younger than me, much older than me, still doing that. So... I think
for me, it always came, it was both selfish and kind of like selfless. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So for me, it was all about documenting what was going on. I thought there was some things going on that I thought there was bands that people would want to check out. And I thought that was important. I thought there was venues doing great stuff that needed to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I just wanted to hear and see bands in my area. I wanted to go out and be able to see the music that I liked played by bands that I liked as well. I wanted to see that.
Absolutely.
And very quickly I realized that in order to do that properly, you have to support the scene, which is often a throwaway line, support the scene. But I thought, well, okay, if that means I have to put shows on, then that's what we're going to do. If that means I have to talk to bands and work with music, then I'm going to do that, because I know that ultimately if it goes well, that bands will start to put us on a touring cycle and go, okay, well, actually, Liverpool is probably worth touring and coming through. And you get the likes of Carcass and then Obituary later on this year that will play and come through now because they realise there is a scene. So I kind of get to see these great bands that I love as well. You know, so for me, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it was almost easy to go, okay, this has to happen. But you're right, it's like, you know, whatever you can do, ladies and gentlemen, you may not be a musician, but there's a multitude, a myriad of stuff that you can do to support your scene, chiefly which going to shows. And absolutely. So, I mean, we've got a whole bunch of stuff to get into there, but so what happened with the band then? What, just walk us through the kind of the sort of maybe the final days of that and the final parts of that.
I haven't got to the middle part yet.
Oh, we've got a whole bunch in the middle there.
That's all right. No, I was just looking at my notes, like, where am I? I mean, when we really sort of took a step up, to be honest, I think it was sort of towards the end of 2004. Tony, who was a drummer, like I say, was a lot older than us. I'm not hating on Tony at all. He's a good drummer. He's a good guy. But we it was sort of mutual consent. You know, we needed to find someone who was like our age. And we had, there was only one person we had in mind, which was Harry Kokola, who has since been the drummer for Neuroma.
Yeah, Neuroma.
And a couple of other bands. And he was just like an outrageous talent. And he wasn't in a metal band at the time, even though he was a big metal head. He was in a band called Checkpoint with Matthew Hirio, who I mentioned earlier. But anyway, so we got him on board, and we just got five times better, honestly, as a band. It just clicked, you know, and the stuff that we were writing instantly got better. Everyone's confidence went up. So it was like, oh, we know we're playing with Harry Kokola now. You know, this is, we need to step our game up a bit. Like, it genuinely was that. Like, we sort of revered them a little bit. And Joel just became this absolute monster of a metal rhythm guitarist. Like, he couldn't play anything else, but he could play metal rhythm guitar like no one's business. You know, we got a couple of 5150s. Woody started really getting into the swing of things. Danny stepped his game up. It was just, everything just went to that next level. Yeah. And that kind of showed in the live experience. I mean, at that point, we started playing venues like, you know, the Barfly and the Mask, and just taking that next sort of step up. And then we were playing with, you know, the bands who were around that time, Multipurpose Chemical, MPC, Metro Manila Raid, Zaprowski, all those kind of guys. And, it was just, we sort of got some really good feedback from the other people in the scene. Like, getting feedback from fans is great, but if you're getting it from people in the scene and you can tell that they actually mean it, you know, that means an awful lot. I remember Jim from MPC coming up to me and he said he'd seen us play like 6 months before. And he's quite a funny guy, Jim. He came up and said, "I'm not going to lie, last time I saw you, I thought you were shit." But today, massive improvement, like so good. Me and Andre were blown away. I was like, wow, that means a lot coming from you guys.
We didn't realize then, we do now, but ladies and gentlemen, we had an embarrassment of riches of some of the bands we had there. You talk about like Multipurpose Chemical. I had Rob on the show. And, I told him, I don't think he realized that, you know, how much what they were doing. People were like, fucking hell, they're breaking through and they're becoming big.
They were sort of rock stars on the local scene, to be honest. They were so entertaining as a live band, which was, we were very aware when we were watching that we had a long way to go, do you know what I mean? And they had a different approach. They were sort of like very tongue-in-cheek and very humorous, and they were musically very different to us. But we massively looked up to them. I mean, they were, if you think of that time, they're obviously one of the first bands you think of.
Yeah, 100%. They were just, and I think, you know, had they been around now, I mean, it's all ifs and whens, but they should have been way bigger than they would have been. Like, you know what I mean?
I think it's massive. All a question of timing, isn't it? I think their style. I think if they would have been around 10 years before, I think they would have been enormous. I think they would have been like a global new metal band. But it's because that. I think that style was sort of was on the wane by then.
It was just probably over the hump of that, wasn't it? It was a shit. And think about, like, you know, Metro Manila Raid. Think about how interesting and how diverse and what they were doing.
Incredible.
An incredible band.
I mean, Paul's obviously gone on to be very successful in Clean Cut Kid and other projects. Yeah. But if there's anyone on the locals, on the scene who was around then, who deserves that, it's him. Because I mean, he played probably 500 shows before that. Do you know what I mean? He was that guy that was like, he was like the opposite of what I said before, you know, that's who's playing that gig. Like, as soon as he got offered a gig, he'd fucking play it. It wouldn't matter if it was in a train station. Like, he'd play it, and he'd play it like he was on, you know, the main stage of Glastonbury.
That was one of the things I remember when I was playing in my bands, that seeing Paul, he's been on the show, he's a good friend, just every time I saw him live, it was an event. It was like, I have to see this guy. Like you say, it could be an opener of a fucking letter, but he made it an event, you know,
because you genuinely didn't know. Like, it was the same with Dress from MPC. You genuinely didn't know what they were going to do next.
I remember a Halloween show at the Zanzi. I'm trying to think who was on the bill, but the thing about the gig was that everybody had to be fancy dress.
Yeah.
So that was the gaff that everybody
was
had
it
to
the
be,
was it the Dead Rockstars one?
That's the one, yeah.
I remember, so yeah.
I told the story a bit. It's my favourite Paul story. It's my favourite story of a gig. So, ladies and gentlemen, so this gig going on to Sands, it's a great venue. And the whole gig is that, you know, you've got to dress as Dead Rockstars. So there's people dressed as Hendrix and Morrison and stuff. Anyway, everybody's excited because Metro Manila are already the headliner, or basically the headliner act. And everybody was excited to see what Paul would dress as, because he was always known to be a very big showman and all the rest of it. So everybody's like, what's Paul going to be at? What's Paul gonna be at? Anyway, so throughout the day, people have got funny costumes. Anyway, it comes to Metro Manila Raid, and he comes out, and he just looks like Saul, or Paul, as we know.
Yeah.
And he's got like a plaid shirt on, and his hair is just like, and everybody was like, okay, so is he trying to be Kurt Cobain? Is that the thing? And we were all like, what the fuck is this? Isn't very good. It's like he hasn't really. What, this is unusual. And he turns around as everybody's kind of mulling away and the band is striking up. And he starts to do stuff, is the best way to explain it.
Of course.
So he's like, do stuff to his face. He can't see quite what's going on. And then he takes his thing off and he turns around and he's Freddie Mercury. And it was. And I remember at the time just thinking, that's the best thing I've ever seen.
He's just unbelievable frontman. He really was.
Yeah.
He still is. Yeah.
Yeah. Still playing loads. And I think we had so many great bands there. You know, like you say, like The Institution and stuff like that. There was so many great showman bands. And I don't think we even realized. And that's why I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, is that when you're going to these shows now, these independent shows with new bands coming through, you have no idea who's going to break through now.
Yeah.
And that's why you should check out as much as you can, because you're going to be able to see people now that in 4 or 5 years' time, you're going to have to pay £100 to see, because they'll have broken through, because they're doing wildly interesting stuff. So then you're improving as a band and you're finding your feet and you're getting good feedback from your peers and stuff like that. Are there shows that stick out now that were really big for you then?
Well, I loved a lot of the shows that we played in the Barfly. That was always my favourite place to play. I think it was sort of the perfect size, you know. And I feel that's where we really sort of stepped our game up. And it was one gig I really liked was, I think it was, was it Matt from Anomaly that put it on? It was, Zabrowski were on it as well. It was 2006. It was in the Carlton Academy downstairs.
Yeah.
Which I hate the upstairs venue, but the downstairs one is really cool.
Why do you hate the upstairs one?
It's just soulless. I don't like it. It's got sweat dripping from the ceiling.
It's difficult to get a good vibe in there, isn't it?
Yeah, the sound's usually bad. It's just not good. It's not a good vibe. But the downstairs one, I really like. It's got that like cavern feel to it. I really like that.
That's a good show.
So we played a gig there. I think that was us at the peak of our powers, to be honest. Because, I mean, this was like I say, when Harry joined me, went to a next level, like a year or so later. We did the second EP then. A year or so later, the stuff we were writing was like up another level still, you know? It's one of my biggest regrets that we never got that stuff recorded, because I'm really proud of that stuff. But it especially like in that live environment, in a fairly intimate venue like that, it was, I think that was probably the best gig we played. That's the one that sticks out to me as thinking like, I think we definitely got something here, you know?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we were very young and we were very stupid and we had no idea what we were doing in terms of marketing, you know?
Yeah.
And like you were saying before, with the scene how it is now, one thing I'm amazed by, young bands, like bands who were the age we were then, like 17, 18, 19, they're so on the ball. Like we never even got merch printed. You know, they've got, I think maybe we got a couple of t-shirts or something, but they've got a full table of merch. They've got like card payments ready to go. They've got all their social medias. They've got QR codes. It's like, why are you not as dumb as we were? Like,
about 2015, 16, around that time, the word brand started to come into a band's lexicon.
Yeah.
So it didn't exist before. I mean, you were in bands, you didn't think about, you had maybe a cool logo or something, but you didn't think about branding. You didn't think about that. You didn't see, because you didn't see yourself as an entity in that respect.
Yeah.
Now, even before the band's played a fucking note, there's a website set up.
Auto shoot.
All the social media is in play. And that's good. You know, there's good elements too, there's bad elements too, but it's largely good. But that whole branding didn't exist. Now, if you go to a show, I was in a show and some guy was kicking off because they could only pay by cash. Yeah. And I was like, we have come a long
this
way.
This is this is an alien place to be.
Yeah, this guy was like, I want to pay on my card and I want to use crypto and stuff. But it was like, but the point being is that, you know, yeah, sort of, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, branding didn't exist. You didn't think of your band in that sort of sense, did you? You didn't think about photos and merch.
You're dead right. I think, obviously, like I say, one reason for it is pure youthful ignorance, you know. Because our plan to get signed was pretty much, someone from Century Media or Roadrunner will turn up at one of these gigs, definitely. They'll definitely turn up to the bar fly on a Tuesday. That's going to happen. It's ignorance, but it was also a weird time. Like, it was a transitional time, I think, from the way the industry was, where everyone was buying CDs, that kind of stopped. But the streaming stuff hadn't really come in. So it was sort of like that few years. Our existence as band coincided with like that 5 years where the music industry was like, what are we going to do? What's our next move sort of thing? And obviously at the same time, we were sort of transitioning from adolescence to adulthood. So it was a very sort of uncertain time. And I think that played into it a lot. I think it was the same for a lot of bands around there. That's why they weren't as sort of anywhere near as professional as you see bands being. Yeah. It's just a different world.
It's a really interesting perspective that I think that maybe thinking about it, that the reason music is cyclical is because technology is cyclical.
Yeah, you know, it dictates what you can do.
Yeah, it's that's what happens. That, like, you know, maybe bands around that time would have been bigger had they had access to the technology that they have now, but it was a lull almost before a whole other wave. I mean, we're still experiencing it now where streaming services haven't, you know, we haven't really got an idea of what's going on, where that's going to go, you know, about how people can earn money from it. And we're still figuring that element out. I imagine in 5 years' time, that'll already be figured out and we'll be on to the next version or iteration of what that is. Yeah. You know, so yeah, that time frame really was, some of it's lost into time. Like you say, none of it was recorded nowadays. That's there would have been five or ten videos of you playing that show.
I remember a couple of our gigs being recorded and a couple of our practices being recorded, but I mean, they'll be on.
You have to bring like a fucking little video camera, VHS, didn't you?
Somewhere, yeah. Well, I mean, maybe slightly smaller than that, but yeah, they'll be on some tape somewhere buried in a closet, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's obviously now you can live stream a fucking gig, you know, was incomprehensible. No one would have even thought about that.
The question then is that sometimes then a distraction from the business of music if you've got to now concentrate, like, you know, almost 60-70% into the branding and merch and how it's all presented? Does that take something away?
I think it can be, but it's a great tool if you use it properly, but you don't want to get lost in it, you know. You don't want to get preoccupied on like, oh, we've got like 15 new YouTube subscribers, we need to do some content for them. It's like your music is front and center, you know. That's why you didn't get into this. Well, maybe some kids did now, but generally speaking, you didn't get into this to be a content creator. You got into this to be a musician, you know, and to make music rather than to make social media posts. So we shouldn't be boomers about it and think that it's all bad. It's not all bad at all. It's a great tool.
Back then, the battle was with getting a decent record deal. That was the battle then, and getting decent sort of contracts. Now the battle is with your soul, if you will, of how much, you know, we see it all the time where bands get burnt out from having to produce so much content that it's ridiculous that, you know, they, a band brings a new album out and the first question is when's the next one out. It's like, can't be that disposable. It has to, there has to be some permanency to what you're doing, you know.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing, it's better to have some, like, to someone in doing that, to have someone whose job is just social media, who's not actually a musician in the band, you know. But who can commit their time to that, whether they get paid or not. Obviously you have to work that out, but I think it's a necessary thing, but try and get someone else to do the bulk of it, I would say.
So what happens then? Are we near the end of the lifespan then, obviously? So where are we with that?
Yeah, I mean, we played our last gig in 2007. That was in Roadkill. It's a really good gig,
I remember.
Towards the end, we played Roadkill a lot. Yeah. And I can't remember, it just kind of, we'd kind of gone as far as we could go on the local scene, and we knew we needed to take that next step, and we didn't really know how. And it sort of, we were getting to that stage where, like, you know, people are starting to go to uni and stuff, people are starting to get new friends, and it's like, it felt like sort of the writing was on the wall a little bit. And it we did that gig, and then it was just one of the, there was no sort of conversation where it's like, okay, we're broke up now. Yeah. But it was just kind of, you know, 1 week goes by without anyone arranging a practice, and then another week goes by. And then that kind of rolled on for about 6 months. And then we thought, actually, do you know what? No, we're leaving a lot on the table here. We can't just leave this. So we decided we were going to get back together. We kind of kept it sort of on the down low. And then there was a gig that I think Joe Mariangi from The Institution was putting on. I think it was Halloween 2008. And that was going to be like our comeback gig.
Yeah.
And we were quite excited about it and stuff. And then, how do I say this? So I had a house party a couple of months before that. And certain events transpired at that house party that led to the relationship between two of the band members becoming untenable. It's like I'm giving a PR statement now, but yeah, basically, someone did something they shouldn't have done, and that was that, really. And we didn't get back together because of that. So it kind of ended not with a bang, but with a whimper, really, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's everybody that's listening now, ladies and gentlemen, everybody that's listening now will have the same question that I'm going to ask now. Okay. And you know what it is, Alex?
I think I might do.
So, how to put it succinctly, where are the pieces of that band?
Right.
Is there a world where those pieces to come together?
Mm.
And is it something you've thought about? Or is it just, you know, is it okay that that was that? And it's lost the time, and it's in its own time capsule.
Well, I mean, obsolete as it was, that is in its own time capsule. That's very much sort of its time. But
yeah,
the pieces of that band are the five individuals in that band. It's, you know, it's me, Joel, Woody, Harry, and Danny. That's it. I'm still on really good terms with all of them. I hardly ever see them. But when I do, it's, you know, it's very pleasant. And
yeah.
It's only this one sort of ruptured relationship that never got resolved.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it happened to be between two of the most sort of vital members of the band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, if we were to do something again, I think it would take a different form. But there's still love for each other there. We still all love heavy music. We're still all active musicians. So as far as I'm concerned, never say never.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, there will be people listening to the show, and I imagine the very people we're talking about will also be listening to this show.
Quite possibly. How you doing, guys?
Look what happened with Ogun. They're probably the best that they've sounded.
Yeah.
It is a lineup change. And, you know, and they're playing some fucking phenomenal shows. I'd like, you know, look.
Sorry, go on.
No, I mean, I would put on a show, and we could make it happen. I'm just saying it's there.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like it would be nice as a coda, if anything else, to just go, look, you know, these songs, some of these songs people have ever heard of. There maybe doesn't even exist recordings of some of these songs, and certainly in a live context. It just feels that it would be nice to finish that chapter, and if it's good, to start another one.
And I mean, to be honest, this is what, like I say, we were so close with Ogun back then. And when I saw them come back, there was a big part of me that was like, why aren't we doing this? And that sort of competition thing came back again, you know.
Yes.
But it was like, yeah, I mean, it's just, like I say, never say no. It's just conversations need to be had. Obviously, as you get older, you're all doing different things, and it's hard to even get people to, like, in your mid-30s, it's hard to even get people to go for a pint in the pub one time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm open to any of those guys who want to reach out to me. We can
let the internet do what it does best. You know, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to this show, and you want to check out Obsolete, and you want them, let's start that conversation. And if you were if you are members of that band, come to me. I'll peace treaty this together. Because
you might have opened Pandora's box here.
Yeah, the one thing I will say is that I thought you guys were fucking great.
Oh, thank you.
Because you were. You know,
how many times did you see us?
I want to say three, but I can only remember two. And I remember one. Roadkill was definitely one of them.
Right.
The Zanzi, I'm sure it was the Zanzi. My memory is pretty awful. Which going up, but I think it was three times. I had a look today, just before it was coming on the show, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. I had a look to see. I've got a couple of drawers of many things with flyers and stickers and shit in there.
Yeah, me
I couldn't
too.
Find it, but I have got some flyers in there. I'll have to dig them out. I'll maybe attach them to the show when I can find them. But yeah,
okay.
I remember thinking, because my band was at the time was the same thing, trying to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, these fucking guys are great. And that's all, that was my endearing memory when ladies and gentlemen, when Alex got in touch to talk about the new projects that he's doing and the new things he's doing, my first thought was, I remember Ali was in the fucking Obsolete. They were great. Yeah. That was what I meant. And I'm sure that there are other people out there. And if I can spill some tea for a second, ladies and gentlemen, when we had Andy on the show from Ogun, and we were talking about that. There was a part of that Andy was like, are we even relevant anymore? Were we even any good? And you know, what the fuck was it? Was it what I remembered? And now I got to see him the first show back. And before he went on stage, I told him what I thought.
Yeah.
And it was nice to see him go out and go, oh shit, this band's still fucking great. And I think Obsolete still are. So let's see.
Thanks,
look, maybe nothing, maybe something, you know. But look, the door's open here.
That's
let's see what happens. Nice.
I mean, thank you for saying that, though, because it does, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Like we never got anywhere commercially successfully, but if people who were around the scene that time, if they saw us and thought, you know what, these guys are fucking good, you know, and we sort of touched them in some way, then that's amazing. That's just that's the end goal.
You enter that rare thing of that you were part of that scene then that flared up and then flared back down again.
Yeah,
you are almost like that OG now. So you're like Ogun, where you are. So when you are the classic wave of metal in the 2000s, you're part of that. So wouldn't you, ladies and gentlemen, wouldn't you want to see one of the classic Liverpool metal bands return? Fucking, I would.
If it did happen, you can guarantee that Ogun would be on the bill as well.
Yeah, boy.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So we get, and it's like, you know, look, you know, there's a world where we could get Zabrowski back. There's a world where it could be done. We just
talk about frayed relationships.
Yeah. We're all big boys now. We're all adults.
That's it.
Some of the stuff that we argue about, this journalist included, argued about, is fucking nonsense. It was rubbish. You know what I mean? And you don't realize now that life's not really, you know, it's not really about those things anymore. There's a bigger picture stuff. So, I mean, what happens for you after Obsolete then? What happens then?
So I went to uni in 2010. So I guess that was a couple of years later. And I've carried on making music that whole time. And I played a lot of solo gigs and acoustic gigs, that kind of stuff. But the the being in a band thing, whenever I tried to get it going again, it just, life sort of got in the way of it, you know?
Right.
But I've always been stayed interested in the production side of things, which is where I've come to now over the last few years. Basically what I'm doing this year is setting up a label, and we are going to be releasing the, I'm doing a split EP at the moment with a guy I mentioned before, Matty, who goes by Castle of the Winds, released his first album a couple of years ago. Fantastic black metal album. And I've been writing a lot of black metal stuff over the last few years, so this is kind of an outlet for both of us. Going to release that this year, and then a full length summer of next year. And by the time the full length LP, my band's called Nil. By the time the full length Nil LP comes out, I'm looking to have a full band together for that. So I am looking at getting back into the, you know, the gigging side of things again, which will be, it's been a while, you know. So,
but it's, look, you know, the scene's missed you, Al. It's missed
thank you.
You know, people that make music and creative people and people within the certainly our metal scene, yeah, you know, are important, mate. You know, you can talk on the scene as it was and as it is now, you know, and don't be fooled. There'll be a lot of young bands that will want to pick your brains about what went on there around. We'll listen to the show and go, oh, well, shit, I mean, what the fuck is the mask? We know any of these
people? Yeah. I mean, anyone who wants to reach out to an old fart about that kind of stuff is fine. Yeah, I'm open to those.
We talked off pod, ladies and gentlemen, about I wanted to do a bigger thing with the label.
Yeah.
And a bigger thing with that, because I thought that there was a lot more conversations that we needed to get into with that, because that's a fascinating thing to me. I think that it's very multifaceted and there's an awful lot of stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're over an hour already. You know, we only just barely covered obsolete. Like, ladies and gentlemen, we're gonna have to get Alex on again. You know, it's nice to talk, it's nice to hear you being passionate about the next project as well. That really excites me, that life.
Yeah, I'd love to come back on and talk about that. This has been an absolute pleasure. Just
it's nice talking about the old days.
But it's no, I think it really was a sort of special time in this scene, and it's good to talk to someone and hopefully hear from, you know, some of you listeners who were around at the same time, who connect with that. So yeah, it's been a great experience to come on. So thank you very much.
No, you're more than welcome, Alex. More than welcome. I mean, like I say, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get Alex on again, and we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff that a little bit more current, but you know, if you're listening to and you want to, you know, we think that maybe Obsolete could do that one-off show again, and we just
really
get
pushing
to hear
us on,
these great songs and this great band from a time when, you know, there wasn't an awful lot of recordings from them. You know, I think that's great. And you know, once you finish with this call, message Andy from Ogun and ask him how much of a fucking ball he's having now being in Ogun now.
Oh, I saw him on Friday. Like he was talking all about it. It's
yeah.
He's
just
given him a new lease on life.
New lease for life.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Because he's got all that knowledge of the scene beforehand, and he's applying it now to this scene now.
Definitely. And go to their next gig, by the way. Everyone who's listening, go to their next gig. I think it's 100%.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get him on again. But it was really nice to talk to Alex Holborn there. Thanks for coming on to the show. Thanks, I really
absolute
appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Thank you, man.
Really nice to talk to Alex Holborn about everything. It's nice to have a stroll down memory lane, wasn't it? And talk about some bands you guys probably have never even heard of. And that's the point, you know, every scene that you've got, whatever country you're in, whatever city you're based, there's always a scene maybe where what the fuck happened to that band? You know, go and start having a dig and start looking for these bands, because they're still out there, you know, and they may just require the slight gentlest of pushes to go and become, you know, could go and do a live show again. You know, how nice would that be? How nice would it be to some of these acts to kind of come back again? It can be done, and it's really worthwhile doing that. You know, these are credible artists. That's great stuff, and it'd be a shame to lose some of the time But it was great, great to stroll down memory lane with Alex there. You know, it's always nice you get. I went back after this pod and pulled up a whole bunch of artists that were actually on the streaming services and checked them out. And it was great to hear some of these fucking tunes again after so long. It was really very cool. And so, you know, there it is. If you are in a band or were in a band and you think, you know what, maybe I should get the band back together, or maybe I should, you know, write some more stuff under that band moniker, then, you know, go at it. There's no time frame on quality. There's no time frame on metal. If it's good, it's good. The end, you know. And if it becomes massive, if it does great, if it doesn't, who cares? You do it because you enjoy it. Do it because you want the world to hear that music again, because there'll be someone out there that'll think that is one of the best songs they've heard. You know, that's how it works. And it's a beautiful thing. It's one of the wonderful things about music. It's one of the quality things about metal. Enjoy the show. I hope you get a lot from it. I hope it makes you entertained, you, as always. I hope it makes you smile. I hope it makes you think. I hope it makes you consider what, you know, the bands that you maybe want to check out again, or, you know, projects that you may be thinking, you know what, I should maybe get to work on that. I've got two very big projects, which I keep teasing. We're very close to announcements now that I'm doing now, which take me out of my comfort zone, if I'm truly honest. But I really want to do them, and I really think they're going to be worthwhile. I'll just tease it a little bit there. But as always, thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.